with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Houck.
Well, good evening, everyone, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, reclaiming that which has always been in you. Very excited to be with you here every other Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. I'm Dr. James Houck, and if you would like more information about me or to leave me your comments about tonight's show, I invite you to visit the website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's all one word right there. So www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And if you would like to join in the conversation, you call the toll-free line. It's 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I will be taking your calls after the break. And just a quick reminder that these broadcasts are podcasted in case you want to go back and listen again, or you can go back into the archives and listen to previous shows, and now available for download on Audible and Amazon Music. Okay. So now, just for those of you who are tuning in for the first time, I wanted to say welcome to the show. Each and every one of these broadcasts are dedicated to the integration of spirituality and our mental health. And for those of you who are also new to the program, I would like to say that I am a firm believer that all of us, every one of us, come into this world already equipped and graced with everything we need in this life in terms of our skills, our talents, our strengths, our character traits, our personalities, our giftedness, and so forth. And yet, we find that perhaps as we go along in life, and maybe due to some unpleasant experiences, we may feel that we need to hide our giftedness, or we need to play down our strengths, or we want to hide our voice, and so forth. You know, we push that giftedness way down so that others cannot see it and or exploit it. Or perhaps growing up, you were told that you would never amount to anything, or whatever other voice you heard telling you that there's nothing special to you. And that's just wrong, because when this happens, we do not realize our giftedness, our skills, our talents, and we go through life functioning from a place of woundedness instead of a place of healing and wholeness and uniqueness, or hachayatas. Well, I get asked all the time, how does one reclaim one's authenticity? I mean, certainly reclaiming that which you have always been and who you are does take great courage and inner strength to change from what is known and comfortable to something that is fresh and new and life-giving. Because when you think about it, that which is unknown to us often contains our greatest potential. And this is hard to see, but to seek our potential by risking that change is the path of true greatness. It requires much effort on our part, but because such action is the true path of greatness, it brings great favor and untold blessings, not just to ourselves, but to many, many others. Well, unfortunately, we often do not see courage in ourselves because we want to hang on to the past, or perhaps we can't imagine something better in our lives, let alone discovering who we really are. So in tonight's broadcast, I'm using courage as the strength that we possess, that empowers us to let go of negative attitudes and distorted perceptions that no longer serve us and that keep us wounded and or victimized, and then taking on something better, something that's more life-giving, more authentic to who we truly are and who we have always been. Or I, as beautifully put, I should say, by my teacher, he says that until there is an acknowledgement of our spiritual nature, we're not going to do the work that is necessary to eradicate this ignorance that binds us. In fact, we will continue to experience the changing joys and sorrows that are associated with this temporary and false states of consciousness, and we will seek gratifying pleasures that only seek to soothe our sorrows. Which, ironically, by the way, always brings us back to how we are nurturing our relationships in terms of, let's say, forgiveness and gratitude and love. And ironically, we often receive our deepest physical and emotional and psychological, even spiritual wounds in and through relationships. And yet, herein lies the irony. We can also discover our greatest healing, our greatest strength and peace and forgiveness and love through healthier relationships. And these relationships just might be within our own families. They just might be our coworkers. They just might be our friends. But you know, when we transform, we also transform others by our presence, by grace, and by understanding. We see people for who they are because we are beginning to see ourselves for who we are. So, first and foremost, forgiveness, kindness, and compassion begin with how we treat ourselves. Because when we are compassionate with ourselves, we then can become more compassionate with others. And when we find that we are forgiving with ourselves, we can then be more forgiving with others. And when we're able to live in gratitude with ourselves, we then discover how this opens up our hearts to see and live in gratitude with others. So all in all, transformation begins with us. In fact, there is so much more to us than what we've become so far. And that's really what reclaiming authenticity is all about. Having this courage to reclaim that which has always been in you and that which you are. So basically, these broadcasts that focus on the integration of our spirituality and mental health also are understood best in terms of relationships. The relationship that we have with ourselves, the relationship that we have with others, and the relationship that we have with God or the divine. So it is my great pleasure to be with you here tonight. I hope that wherever you are today, that you are safe and that you're at peace. And I'll be taking your calls in a little while because I really want to hear from you on today's subject, the psychological, emotional, and spiritual benefits of after-death communication. Well, I tell you what, let's begin tonight with a question. How many of you have ever been contacted by a loved one after they have passed away? How many of you have ever been contacted by a loved one after they have passed? Maybe it was a very, very vivid dream. Maybe it was a vision. Maybe you heard their voice. Maybe you smelled their perfume or cologne. Maybe you sensed their presence through technology, like, say, on your phone. Or maybe you saw their favorite animal, one that's not well seen in the parts in which you live. Well, if you have, chances are that you've had an after-death communication. So let me take a moment and tell you how I became involved in after-death communication, or ADC. It all started early in my career as a mental health practitioner and pastoral professional that I was involved with bereavement counseling. And helping people through their loss and grief issues seemed to come naturally to me because I grew up experiencing many losses in my life. In fact, in all actuality, death and dying was nothing new to me. However, what was new to me was the way people shared their stories of how their loved ones showed up later. They didn't share so much about the details of their loved ones coming to them and their dreams or visions and so forth, but rather I noticed more of how these appearances, these visitations, made them feel. Because as they talked, I sensed a wave of peace, an assurance, a reassurance that came over them like they never experienced before. In fact, they told these stories in a very peaceful manner. Not in a matter-of-fact tone, but in a way in which they knew their loved one was all right, safe, and whole. They would say things like, "Well, yeah, my grandmother showed up the other night in my dreams and told me that I was going to be okay." Or there were other times when they said, "I was out walking last week and I smelled my father's cologne and I could swear he was walking right beside me." And one woman shared with me that a few years after her husband's death, she would find dimes on the ground or on her dresser or in other, you know, just interesting places. And she didn't put the dimes out there, but she knew that her husband did because they were all face up. And one 14-year-old girl, who I will never forget, shared with me the times when her grandmother would show up. I was counseling her for major depression. And of course, we got to talking about her grandmother who had passed away 6 to 7 months prior to us working together. And, how close were you with your grandmother and what lessons had she, you know, shared with you and so forth. And she started talking about how her grandmother would show up every night. And, her story went like this, that each night she would do her homework down in the finished basement. You know, after dinner or supper, she would go down there and start doing her homework. And there was a mantle clock that sat on this, chimney. And it would always chime 7 times as if, you know, it was 7 o'clock. But it was the same time that her grandma had passed. And the interesting thing was that I had asked, "Oh, okay, well, does it chime any other time? Like, does it chime 5 times at 5 o'clock or 2 times or 2 o'clock? And she goes, "No, 7 times, and that's it." And I said, "Oh, okay, well, you know, maybe you could unplug the clock." And she said, "No, it's not plugged in, and there are no batteries. In fact, the clock is broken." And to make matters even more interesting, the hands on the clock were positioned at 1 o'clock. And the girl always took away a healthy reassurance that grandma was with her, that every time she was down there 7 times, it chimed. And she would just say, "Hi, grandma." Now, in all honesty, I don't know how after-death communications work. I mean, I don't know if our loved ones go up and tap God on the shoulder and say something like, "God, it's been a while, but is it okay if I just pop down there for a little bit? I mean, just 5 minutes. Please, just 5 minutes. And I promise I'll be right back. No, I'll be right back. I promise. I won't be long. Okay? All right, thanks." I don't think that happens that way, but you know, it's kind of comical. You know, do they have to get God's permission to pop in? I don't think so. Well, at any rate, when a loved one passes, there is a natural urge in us to stay connected to our loved ones. And this is normal, you know, because we want to hang on to pictures or stories that they told or jewelry that had been handed down and so on and so forth. And interestingly, in earlier bereavement studies, there was this advice that was given to grieving survivors. And it was for us to hurry up and get over our losses as quickly as possible and to get rid of or donate our loved ones' possessions, and then move on with our lives and start connecting with other people. Well, the problem with that advice was that it really didn't help people grieve thoroughly. In fact, it actually, it taught us to stuff those feelings and memories of our relationships deep down inside of ourselves, which then only made matters worse when it came to working through our grief, because it totally ignored the fact that we will always be connected to our loved ones. In fact, we are always connected to our loved ones. And we will be always connected with them as we are reminded of birthdays, or anniversaries, or weddings, or funerals, or holidays, or vacations, and any other day that they come to mind. And these times are very normal and healthy for us. Okay, let me just stress that again. These times are very normal and healthy for us, even if the memories we have are not so great or very painful. And when this occurs, it reminds us that grief is a process and it's going to take time. We don't say goodbye all at once. It's a process. Well, I think one of the first things that needs to be cleared up for many people who don't quite understand after-death communication or even fear it is, beginning with what it's not. Okay, so an after-death communication is not us trying to make contact with our loved ones or going to the place of their, their death and calling out, "Hello, are you there? Hello." Secondly, after-death communication is not about us breaking out a Ouija board and contacting our loved ones to get a message about our next big purchase or asking for help making a decision about whether or not it's the right time for us to get married. And after-death communication is not about attending a séance to make contact with the other side to see whether or not heaven is for real. But instead, what after-death communication is that our loved ones reach out to us because they are universal in that they occur for anyone, regardless of differences in culture or religions or even language. In fact, it's also interesting that people living in Eastern countries expect these after-death communications to occur because they believe very much in the internal connection with their ancestors. And people, we who are living in the West or the Western part of the world, we're coming around to that. We're coming around to it. But definitely people living in Eastern countries, this is what they grew up with. This is what they believe. This is very much a part of their lives. And after-death communication is also very spontaneous in that they're random. And they could occur at any time, whether we are awake or asleep. And most of the time, an after-death communication occurs when we are simply minding our own business. And what I discovered most is that after-death communications are multiple, because most of the time, people receive more than one, such as they've had a dream and a vision, or they had a dream and hearing the voice of their loved one, and so on and so forth. And this was also something that I discovered in my own research with after-death communication and just simply listening to people talk about their experiences. And I presented a paper about the universal, multiple, and spontaneous characteristics of after-death communication. It was at an international near-death experience conference down at Virginia Beach back in 2004. And I spoke about how people experience loved ones who would show up in dreams. And we all dream of our loved ones. But again, these dreams that, people swear that they are real. Other people would have visions that would only last a few seconds and then it's gone. But people would swear that they recognized who was there. They would also hear their loved ones calling their name, or some would sense their loved one's presence through, like I said, an animal that shows up at random, where, you know, an animal typically did not live, or let's say the animal was a favorite of your loved one. Could have been a peacock, a small bird, like cardinal. Maybe it was a deer. Maybe it was a snake. Maybe it was a cougar. You never know. And some people would actually hear their loved one's voice through the phone. Or let's say your phone would ring once, you'd pick up, nobody was there, but you swear your loved one was on the other end. You just had that feeling. And as I said, some people would report finding like heads up pennies or dimes in random places, or some would sense a loved one's presence through smelling their cologne or perfume. And all in all, people receive more than one after-death communication. In fact, as often as two, three, or more throughout their lives. And as I listen to people share, you know, their after-death communication stories about a loved one, I really became interested in how these experiences affected the person in terms of working through their own issues of loss and grief. Did these encounters help them make sense of their loss? Was there a larger purpose behind them? Did these visitations help people of faith? Did these visitations help people who did not have faith? Was this, you know, the evidence needed to prove that there is a heaven? Or was this a way for loved ones to have the closure that they needed? You know, did the person experience an after-death communication, did they need that extra assurance that their loved one was okay and healed, forgiven, and whole? And if this is the case, why doesn't everyone who experiences the loss of a loved one receive these visitations at one time or another? And herein lies the psychological, emotional, and spiritual benefits of after-death communication. So as I said at the beginning of the hour, I would really love to hear your heart on this matter. Or if you would like to share your own story of an after-death communication, I invite you to call in. That number is 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after this break. So again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. And I'm your host, Dr. James Houck. I'll be back with you in 1 minute. Okay, welcome back. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Again, I just want to share with you a quick word about the next show. It's going to be on Wednesday, November the 8th. And yes, I said November. Okay, Wednesday, November the 8th at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And in that broadcast, I'll be sharing stories related to near-death experiences. So, as I've been talking about earlier with after-death communication, certainly after-death communication and near-death experiences, I think, go hand in hand, you know, very similar, yet they have their own distinct characteristics, as well as their own distinct purpose and meaning in our lives. because in a near-death experience, a person is either clinically dead or they're near death, or maybe they're in a situation where death is likely to occur or it's expected. So, let's say, following the stopping of one's heart and after being resuscitated, some people report having sensed various images or sounds, all while, let's say, dead. And as I said, you know, they're revived from that, and they, you know, they find that their lives from that point on take a 180-degree turn for the better. So, I invite you to mark your calendars now for the next Reclaiming Authenticity broadcast on Wednesday, November the 8th at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Well, so far, I've been talking about how I came to understand and work with people who have experienced an after-death communication. And as I said, I was involved with bereavement counseling, you know, helping people through their loss and grief issues, and how that came naturally to me, since I grew up experiencing many losses in my life. In fact, death and dying was nothing new to me. I believe I was somewhere around 9 years old when I experienced the death of my great-grandmother. And from that point on, it seemed to be, you know, I was just thrust into having to deal with death and dying in just many forms, situations, many experiences, saying goodbye to loved ones, so on and so forth. And yet, what was new to me was the way that people would share their after-death communication stories of how their loved ones showed up. I mean, they didn't share so much, you know, the details of their loved ones coming to them in dreams or visions, but rather I noticed how these visitations, these appearances, made them feel. And as they talked, it was clearly, I could see it clearly on their face, this peaceful assurance that came over them like never before. In fact, they told their stories in a very peaceful manner. You know, not in a matter-of-fact tone where like one would report historical events, but in a way in which they knew that their loved one was going to be okay, or that their loved one was safe, or that their loved one was whole. And these experiences with after-death communication are important, very important, because after all, regardless of when a loved one dies, nobody is ever fully ready to say goodbye. Even if our loved one is struggling with a, let's say, a slow progressive illness, and we see their impending death, and the finality of witnessing them take their last breath brings their death right to the forefront of our hearts and our minds. And in those incidences, we like to think we had a chance to say everything that we've always wanted to say to that person, and vice versa. But how often do we, at some point later, struggle with some aspect of our relationship with them? And however, there's also times that when the death of a loved one comes without warning, and we don't have time to say goodbye, and we feel like we don't have closure with them. Now, in this sense, a loved one reaching out to us through an after-death communication can be the means by which we find forgiveness, can be the means by which we find that peace, and we find assurance that everything is going to be okay. And the same process could be said regarding finding healing from the emotional wounds of loss and grief. You know, but a common misperception out there and misunderstanding is that once we have assimilated our losses, that we will go back to where we were before the loss, you know, in our original emotional and spiritual state. But this, let's return to the way things were, rarely happens. Instead, we are constantly shaped and changed by our losses. You know, there was a time when I was called on to officiate at the funeral of a little girl who I'll call Megan. And she was all but maybe 8 years old. And she had died from a AIDS-related death. And the funeral home, it was standing room only, you know, just not a dry eye in the house. Because when a child dies, even though we don't like it, everybody comes out. Everybody has to say goodbye. Everybody grieves, not only the death of a child, but also their future. You know, what kind of life she would have led? Would she have chosen to stay single, or would she want to marry? And if she married, would she want to have kids, and how many, and so forth? You know, what kind of career would she have chosen, and things like that. And so, like I said, I was asked to officiate at this funeral for Megan. And I got the backstory from the family, and you know, she was born with AIDS, and you know, just her mother, they don't know how she contracted it, but this little girl just simply did not stand a chance. And so I saw her once in the hospital. I just, you know, wanted to, you know, introduce myself and have a prayer with her, and just hold her hand and just, you know, just be with her, just be with her. And so when the time came to do the funeral, like I said, it was a very small casket, and nobody wants to see that, not even funeral directors. But, you know, I talked about her life and, you know, grieving the future and so on and so forth. And then we had a graveside service, and, you know, I just made my rounds afterwards, just saying goodbye to the family members and friends and so forth. And I just thought, okay, that would be the end of it. However, about 3 weeks later or so, you know, I would say, I get this phone call, and here it was her grandfather. And, you know, he's like, "Dr. Houck, you know, I'm in the hospital right now, and you have to come see me. I mean, can you do it this afternoon? Please. I just need to talk to you." And I said, "Okay, yeah, I'll be there, let's say 2:00. And so we hung up, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, you know, this grandfather not only lost his granddaughter, but now he probably received some terminal illness news, and he doesn't know what to do, but he wants to talk it out or have prayer or something. So I go in there, and he's, you know, sitting up actually in his bed, and he had the strangest worried look on his face, like he was trying to figure something out. And so I just, you know, smiled and gave him a quick wave, and I go, you know, I'll just call him John for the sake of that, and I go, "Hey John, you know, what's going on?" And you know, I pulled up a seat, you know, behind him, or I'm sorry, not behind him, beside him, where he was on the bed. And so we're kind of looking right at each other. And he goes, "Now, Dr. Houck, I'm going to tell you something, and I don't want you to call me crazy." And I said, "Okay, you don't have to worry about that, because I don't use that word at all. But, you know, what's going on?" And so he said that last night, before he had called me, about 3:00 in the morning, he was sound asleep. He says, "I swear I was sound asleep." And all of a sudden, he was just, you know, awakened out of this deep sleep, shot right up out of bed. And at the end of his bed was Megan. And she was, you know, seated at the end of his bed in, you know, just a beautiful, nice white gown, you know, like a pajama kind of deal. And, you know, she looked healthy and whole. And you know, she turned her head and gave him a little smile. And she gave him just, you know, a couple of waves with her hand. And she vanished. And he said, "Now, am I going crazy?" And I said, "Well, first of all, John, you told me not to tell you that." But I said, "No, you're not going crazy. I think what you received was this tremendous gift." Because think about it this way. What was your last memory of Megan? You saw her in her casket. which nobody wanted to see. And she looked emaciated. She looked, you know, sickly and so forth. I said, but this vision, the way you described, you know, she was healed, healthy, whole, happy, smiled at you, waved to you. She knew who you were and everything was. And I said, all in all, I think it's a gift. And he kind of thought about it for a little bit. And he goes, you know what? I never understood that before. And this was a man of faith. I mean, he had the faith. He believed, you know, life after death. But he had never had an experience like this before. And it really, for lack of a better phrase, it really rocked his world. You know, it really shook him up. And, you know, it was just, he was never the same after that. He had this incredible peace coming over him as I saw him again once he got out of the hospital. And he was just in there for some tests anyway. But I did manage to catch up with him. And he just had this incredible peace all over his face. In fact, he was very happy. And he told me some more stories about Megan, you know, that I didn't even hear of, you know. And you can tell that he was just very proud to be her grandfather. So, you know, once we have experienced a loss, and this is just losses in general, our outlook on life is forever altered by the grief that we sustain, the grief that we experience. And the reason why our outlook on life is forever altered is because our assumptions about life and the world in which we live have now been challenged, if not shattered. Because we've been accustomed to the routines which defined our daily existence. We love patterns. We love things that are predictable. We kind of grew up in a world of like, okay, people love each other, they fall in love, and they get married, and they live happily ever after. And you and I both know that's not always the case. Or it could be some other, you know, hey, I worked hard all my life and I paid my taxes and everything, or I went to school for the career I wanted to, and I wanted to get out and get a good paying job, and that didn't happen. So again, what do we do when our assumptions have been shattered? But yet, you know, instead of assimilating our losses into our everyday lives and working through these assumptions, many people kind of resist this healing by continuing to live in a prison, let's say, of emotional and or psychological bitterness that's often reinforced by familiar patterns of abuse or low self-esteem, excuse me, or feelings of unworthiness, or feelings of contempt or jealousy or strife or whatever other negative emotions out there. And yet, instead of looking for the potential of how can we be made better by working through our losses, we allow bitterness to harden our hearts. And in doing so, we keep others out, all the while cementing this anguish inside of us. So the challenge then is for us to discover this courage to redefine ourselves in light of our pain and grief. But you know, when this occurs, we are compelled to ask this question. Is this assimilation process something that we're able to do on our own, or do we need help from others? Well, you see, I've learned that after-death communication can be experienced at any time because it doesn't depend on us. But rather, I strongly believe that it depends on what is needed at the time. Well, many years ago, I met Dr. Ken Doka, D-O-K-A, who had done extensive research in the area of palliative care and hospice. And as we sat in his office at the College of New Rochelle in the Bronx, we talked about the importance of rebuilding our faith and philosophical assumptions that have been challenged or even shattered by our loss and grief. And what impressed me most about that conversation was how he explained how most of us live our lives according to our assumptions, and how grief causes us to re-examine our core beliefs about, let's say, how life ought to operate. And after-death communication really causes us to rethink a lot about the finality of death. You know, when we experience the pain of losing a loved one to death, or, you know, our unchallenged assumptions about life or fairness in the world, even the goodness of God, often muddy the waters of this process of our grief and mourning. And unconsciously, you know, we may wonder why we are not allowed to live happily ever after, or question what is it that we have done that God is punishing us. However, the truth is that death and dying are very much a part of life and living. And death is merely a transition from this life to the next. And hopefully the awareness of our own mortality and ultimately who we are as a soul awakens us to become better, not bitter, people of faith. And although we have become accustomed to the routines which define our daily existence, we will never see ourselves or others or the world the same as we once did, because we are pulled into the task of trying to make sense out of new circumstances in light of the old. And yet, if we think about it, once we're able to comprehend that death is real, and that someday we too shall die, despite how difficult that may be for us, our worldview changes. It changes from the naive innocence of life and pleasure and being cared for to a realization that we must confront our own sickness, aging, and death. Well, you know, one of my favorite books out there is an ancient story told of the spiritual journey of an Indian man called Siddhartha, who lived during the time of the Buddha. And if you've never read the book, it's a great read. It's a little book, but you'll want to read it again and again and again. So within Buddhism, there is a belief that there is nothing fixed and permanent in this world. In other words, everything and everyone is subject to change. Or as the Buddha taught, it is a continuous becoming. And we refer to this as impermanence. And if you have ever sat beside a river and just watched its flow, you get the idea. You know, the water runs from point to point around rocks and fallen branches and finding the way of least resistance. And yet at the same time, the river is not just one continuous united flow. The river of this moment, let's say, is not going to be the same as the river of the next moment. And hence comes a saying from the ancient philosopher Heraclitus, "You cannot step into the same river twice, for the other waters are ever flowing onto you." And interestingly, this same philosophy can be applied to our lives, that none of us remain the same throughout our years. Oh, we may think that we're not changing, but we are. You know, the various stages of our lives, from childhood to adolescence to adulthood to old age, are not the same at any given time. The child is not the same when he or she grows up and becomes a young adult, nor when he or she grows elderly. And while it's true that, you know, we want to live from moment to moment, we tend to forget that each moment leads to the next. Impermanence and change are thus the undeniable truths, let's say, of our existence. And there's also perhaps a very important point that after-death communication helps us with, and that's within the context of disenfranchised grief. Because you see, disenfranchised grief is that phenomena which I call the double bind, where a lot of people would find themselves, you know, in this double bind. Well, most people who mourn the loss of a loved one are free to experience normal grief reactions, others whose loved ones carry a social stigma are not given the right or the role or even the capacity to grieve as many others. And added to this, these mourners are given little or no social or religious support to help facilitate their grief. And this is something else Kendoka and I, you know, talked about, because he had written a book on disenfranchised grief, which I just, you know, very good, one of the best reads ever. And in that book, he argued that the reason for this reaction by society arises from one or more of the following factors. He says that people find themselves in disenfranchised grief because the relationship they had to the deceased is not recognized. You know, perhaps they divorced that person and they're just simply not welcomed at the funeral. Or perhaps it was a marriage or a union that was forbidden by the family. And so when, you know, that loved one dies, we're not going to recognize that loss. Or let's say the loss itself is not recognized, or maybe even viewed by society as significant, such as the loss of a pet or a prenatal death. Now, I will say that society is getting better on this. You know, there are some Hallmark cards out there that really focus on the death of a child or the death of a baby, stillbirth, you know, and so forth, as well as the loss of a pet. And I have to say firsthand that veterinarians have really got on board with this faster than Hallmark, because they know the sensitivity and the impact that a pet's death has on an individual or a family. And another aspect of why society, you know, would want to disenfranchise a person's grief is that the surviving loved one is perceived by society as not having the capacity to mourn properly, such as young children, or let's say the elderly. You know, and I've witnessed too many times that, well, she's too young, she's not going to remember, or he's too old, he's senile, and he's not going to remember. And that is not true. That is not true. Whether they are very young or very, very old, people sense something's wrong. They sense the death of a loved one. And I have talked with way too many adults who were kept from the funeral of a grandmother or a great-grandfather or whoever, you know, because they were children. You know, like, well, now you're just going to stay home with the neighbor lady or something like that. And they really resent the fact that somebody else made that decision for them because they really wanted to be there, but yet they were kept. And so they fell into this disenfranchised grief and didn't know what to do with their feelings, their thoughts, and so forth. And lastly, you know, another aspect of, you know, disenfranchised grief is that there are certain types of death, still to this day, there are certain types of death which may be too embarrassing or produce a heightened anxiety in members of society to allow that to be put in a newspaper of really, how did the person die, or the obituary, or something. And I'm talking about suicides and AIDS-related deaths. Suicide is getting a little bit better, a little bit better. There are suicide support groups. There are a few AIDS-related death support groups, but the suicide support groups are starting to come around a little bit more. You start to see them, and people are encouraged to seek help. And, you know, as I said, not just with support groups, but also with you know, neighbors or those who knew the person, because, you know, they're, you know, suicide is not something you just wake up one day and said, gee, I think I'll do that. But they see how, you know, the person was tormented and they feel as though that there was nothing they could do or that they couldn't do enough and so forth. Okay. So, that is what lends itself to people becoming disenfranchised. And after death communication, when a loved one shows up at random, it kind of blows the doors off, if I can say that, blows the doors off disenfranchised grief. Because now the people feel like they have everything they need to begin sharing about their loved one and sharing how their loved one showed up. And they're not afraid anymore of what people will think, because after all, this is my loved one. And when they fully understand, you know, all the characteristics and the impact and the emotional and the mental and the spiritual healing that can take place from an after-death communication, they're silent no more. They will no longer be disenfranchised. So in a way, after-death communication really enfranchises or empowers others to share these stories. So let's say the last thing I want to share tonight is, you know, perhaps you're in the business, you know, either a first responder or, you know, somebody who works with people. Maybe you're a grief counselor, social worker, maybe you're a therapist, or maybe you are a concerned family member. Maybe you've had your own after-death communication. And so for those who work in the areas of loss, bereavement, and disenfranchised grief, listening to a survivor's story of an after-death communication of a loved one also helps reassure them that they're not going crazy, that an after-death communication is experienced by thousands and thousands of people to help them come to terms with their losses. It also helps them identify the type of support that they might need and what support is desired. You know, would they want, you know, an individual, like one-on-one, or wouldn't they be better suited for, you know, a support group in which they can share these stories and they will not be judged, but they will be fully supported. And, you know, listening to a survivor story of an after-death communication with a loved one also helps them identify any unmet needs, such as secondary losses, or let's say the loss of an income, or their role in the family. And maybe they need help dealing with, you know, their feelings about not getting needs for support and why those needs are not getting met. And, you know, perhaps the, you know, mourner's expectations of support to determine whether or not it's appropriate, and really helping them readjust if inappropriate, and helping them avoid, you know, self-medicating through drugs or alcohol. And also, you have a chance to assess the lack of support to determine whether it's due to a lack of assertiveness on the person who's grieving, or maybe it's another psychological issue. Okay. And lastly, you know, sharing an after-death communication story can really help educate a person that support for disenfranchised grief often can be found in support groups or printed material, books and so forth, or DVDs and that. It's just, there's a lot of great support out there, not just on disenfranchised grief, but also on after-death communication. So I am Dr. James Houck, and you have been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Thank you for spending this hour with me. And again, the takeaway for tonight, I would say, is, you know, if you have experienced an after-death communication with a loved one, cherish that story, cherish that memory, write it down. Not that you're going to forget it, but write it down. Share these stories and tell others, you know, just how special your loved one was. Or if you did have a great relationship with your loved one and you receive an after-death communication, how does it help you resolve these issues with them? Does it lead you toward forgiveness and forgiving yourself and forgiving them in some way? So I will talk to everybody in 2 weeks. In the meantime, everybody be careful out there. Everybody be safe. And first and foremost, everybody behave yourselves. I will talk to you in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.
or an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding around to buy a book by Dr. Hauk. It's all there. Just wander over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific, on BBS Radio TV.